Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Greetings and welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight I'm going to be talking to Aaron Daba of Esoterics, and that is ESOTERX.com, and it is a fantastic blog. And I'm going to read real quick the about here on Esoterics, because I think it's pretty cool. Esoterics is an anthropological investigation of the ontological status of things that go bump in the night. The fact that monsters may or may not be corporeal is of no consequence. As Charles Baudelaire said, I consider it useless and tedious to represent that which exists because nothing that exists satisfies me. Nature is ugly, and I prefer the monsters of my fancy to what is positively trivial. Born in a log cabin behind the Institute for Psychical Research, Aaron is an applied anthropologist by training, inclination, and neurosis, masquerading as a computational linguist and software engineer by day, busy accumulating obscure master's degrees in an attempt to assemble a set of letters after his name that spontaneously result in some sort of gematriac significance. I'm convinced the universe is a far weirder place than we like to admit, and the only reasonable response is that recommended by Hunter Thompson: when the going gets weird, turn pro. We do an extra Patreon segment with Aaron as well, talking about a demon that once testified in court. But these are some really interesting stories. I hope you're going to enjoy it, and I plan on having him back sometime fairly soon, actually. There's a lot of stuff on his blog to go over, and he's a really interesting guy. So here we go, my conversation with Aaron Daba. And so I'm speaking with Aaron Daba of Esoterics, and the subtitle to your blog, which is what Esoterics is If Monsters Don't Exist, Why Are They Out to Get Me? And I freaking love that. How you doing, Aaron?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Sarai?
All right. So tell me a little bit about where the blog came from and where the title came from.
Well, mostly it's that you're kind of reading my neurosis in print on the web, and it came from a need that I saw to differentiate strange phenomena from natural science. Hmm. And to do it in the sense that there's a certain absurdity in our monsters and like things that go bump in the night. And I don't mean absurd that we kind of laugh at it and toss it out, but it, in the sense of absurdism, we're the tendency to seek inherent meaning in life and our inability to find any. And that seems like a pretty horrible characterization of human existence, but I kind of follow H.P. Lovecraft's observation that even from the greatest horrors, irony is seldom absent. So I figure we can at least get a laugh out of it.
Okay.
I'm fascinated with strange history, and not necessarily to the extent of ancient aliens or super civilizations, but I like the little details in history that are weird and that go unnoticed mostly. Mm-hmm. A good example of that, I ran across this just recently and put an article up on it, that there was a major volcanic eruption in 1808 that changed the climate for a few years, cooled it down a bit, and no one noticed it.
It was really?
There were other eruptions during the time. There were eruptions in the Azores, and they saw those. And there were eruptions in 1818. There was Mount Tambora or something like that, that led to the year without a summer.
Right.
People noticed these, recorded them. In 1808, there was one, nobody noticed it. The only reason they know about it is because we did some Antarctic ice cores, and they apparently study pine cones to determine if a volcanic eruption happened. And they said between 1808 and 1809, there was a colossal eruption somewhere on the planet that changed the climate. And colossal, believe it or not, is the technical term for the size of the eruption. And it goes something like mild to mega colossal. And mega colossal is like if the Yellowstone, you know,
right,
the caldera explodes. But the Pinatubo was they have something called the volcanic explosivity index, and it's all about how much stuff gets thrown into the air and how high the plume is and how loud it is and things like that. And this one rated pretty high. It was on the same order of Pinatubo, or I think it may have been near Krakatoa sized. And absolutely nobody noticed it. It was recorded. It wasn't recorded anywhere. And sometime in the late 1990s, there were a PhD student and a professor. They were either climatologists or volcanologists, were trying to figure out why they were getting these weird core samples that said there was an eruption. So they started digging around, and the only references they could find were these guys in Bogota. It was the director of the Astronomical Observatory of Bogota between 1805 and 1810 that said something like, there's a transparent cloud that's obstructing the sun's brilliance. And then another guy at the same time in Colombia said he saw something similar, and that there was that probably indicated there was like a sulfuric acid, you know, aerosol cloud coming from a volcanic explosion somewhere west of Colombia. But And it would be 2,600 miles long, given the two guys who were were reporting it. But no one had anything to say about it. And they just guess where it happened, somewhere between Indonesia and Tonga, and that's all they can say.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's like these things that are just kind of go. I mean, Charles Fort would have called it, you know, damn data. This is, you know, it gets, you know, it obviously happened, but nobody saw it, heard it, reported it. And I mean, they talked to the locals in the South Pacific, and there was, you know, there's local folklore about eruptions, but nothing that fit the time frame. So it happened, changed the climate, nobody noticed.
That's crazy.
But I like that stuff. Yeah, I like stuff that you know, spans millennia and repeats, and you hear stories again and again, and that you hear it from different cultures, from different noted experts of the time. And a lot of these noted experts, of course, like in 1 BC, you know, and things like
right.
that. But a good example of this is the war between the Pygmies and the Cranes, which they don't teach in school, obviously.
Yeah. And,
it apparently was a millennia-long conflict between Pygmies and Cranes that spanned several continents.
Now, explain who the Pygmies and Cranes are.
Well, the cranes are the bird.
Okay, so we're talking about an actual bird.
With the actual bird, the cranes, and pygmies, well, I mean, that comes obviously out of the Greeks, who called anybody shorter than them and foreign a pygmy.
Yeah.
But they actually specify, and across several different cultures, that no longer than the length of a forearm. So we're talking about, what, 7 inches high, a foot at most.
Huh.
And that the cranes basically carried out a genocidal war against the pygmies. And, you know, there really aren't any pygmies anymore, and there are a lot of cranes, so I guess we can tell who won.
Wow, so these were really small pygmies.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was... traditional. I mean, that was where the name comes from in Greek. Pygmy, it means length of the forearm, and so, you know, foot tall, no bigger than that, which makes sense if you've ever run into a crane, because they're like nasty birds, and they'll take on a full-sized human if they feel like it.
Yeah.
But, you know, so obviously they wouldn't be afraid of pygmies, but it gets mentioned across the world, and dating even back to, it's mentioned in Homer's Iliad as something that they already knew about. Because he compares the conflict between the Greeks and Trojans to the ferocity of the ageless conflict between pygmies and cranes, which is like, wow, that he knew about it in, what, 710 BC, and it had already been going on for a while, and it was apparently pretty nasty. And
well, it makes me think too of the Sirius alien there too that Greer found that was only like a foot tall.
Yeah, I mean, we have countless cultures have story. I mean, even you can even like look at fairies and say maybe these are, you know,
memories of real people at some point.
Yeah, some version of the pygmies that the Greeks were talking about. But
what's interesting is that you look at 2nd century BC tombs in the Crimean Peninsula, and a lot of the tombs depict battles between pygmies and, well, in this case, they happen to be herons, but they're morphologically similar to cranes, so who can tell? You know, maybe your artist just couldn't tell the difference. And Pliny the Elder, the Roman naturalist in the early opening of the AD, 23 AD or so, he brought up the fact that the pygmy were actually believed to have been displaced from their ancestral homeland by the cranes.
Huh. Well, again, I guess it makes sense if they were literally, you know, a foot tall or something like that, that these birds could be a terror to them.
Oh, absolutely. But they apparently, the pygmies originally were in Scythia somewhere, around the Black Sea coast of Thrace. And the cranes are mentioned actually also by Aesop in his fables, and said that the cranes found Greece to be kind of unfriendly and started spreading out, and started by settling on the lands of the pygmy in Scythia, and then kept moving. And after that, the pygmies seemed to have dispersed. And in Greece, of course, you know, anything for a good story, the Greeks talked about how the Greek gods were angry at the pygmies, particularly a disrespectful queen of the pygmies had pissed them off. You know, these Greek gods, they have big egos, and it can pretty much piss them off anyway.
Right.
And they mete out punishments way out of proportion to whatever the offense is. And this queen married somebody, and Hera found fault with it, and it was a whole, you know, love triangle thing, and really ugly. But and so the pygmy were then set upon by the cranes at the behest of the Greek gods. But that's the usual, you know, they came up with divine punishments for all sorts of things in Greece. But at that point, they were fractured, and you get stories about small clusters of them in Egypt, Ethiopia, believe it or not, Arctic Canada, the Himalayas, and they're talked about by Aristotle in about 322 BC as settled pretty solidly in southern Egypt, but getting raided continually by the cranes.
Wow.
Yeah, so these cranes are really like after them. And again, it spreads out across the world. You have 14th century AD Italian missionary what was his name? Friar Odric, and Arab scholars of the 14th century who were starting to have contact with China talked about remnant populations of pygmy getting attacked by angry cranes in the Himalayas. And then you get Chinese records from the Chinese annals that say in the 5th century, it's the Shenai King, so, you know, the big book of Chinese myths and legends and things that a lot of references are made to. And they talk about a land where there are men and women who are only 7 inches tall, that are desperately afraid of cranes, and then the cranes travel 1,000 miles and try to gobble them up, which is very strange.
Yeah.
But you can go from culture to culture, and the Norse talk about the Skerling in the Arctic, and they say that the pygmy were trying to find safe havens from the cranes, and they were still set upon by these terribly nasty cranes. It's mostly, you know, obviously they were the cranes can project air power, so they have a slight advantage there.
What made you think to look into this more?
It was a Thoreau quote I ran across that made absolutely no sense to me, and I wanted to see what the heck he was talking about. And then it's Henry David Thoreau wrote, "Like pygmies, we fight with cranes," and that was all he said. And I said, well, you know, where did this come from?
Right.
All about. But you get stories from the Roman historians like Pliny about them in Egypt and Ethiopia, and it gets detailed about the conflict, the strategies that the Pygmies had for fighting them. Like they would go out to the beaches and try and break the crane's eggs before they could hatch another generation of super soldiers, you know. And the Pygmy are said to have introduced the world's first goat and sheep-based cavalry to fight them.
Wow.
Yeah, but it continues into the into North America. There's Cherokee legends about a small people that are under attack by, well, they said the local geese population, which obviously there's some sort of a military compact with the cranes. But
sure, sure.
Yeah. And the Cherokee said they were quite descriptive about it. They said that the Pygmy really didn't have many weapons, and the birds just stuck their long beaks into their houses and tried to pull them out and eat them. And eventually they were wiped out. And there's other stories from other Native American groups that also mention these little people. And so it's, like I said, you don't see any Pygmies anymore, but you do see a lot of cranes. So yeah, we kind of know what happened.
Yeah, obviously. what is your, okay, so when you look into this stuff, what is your take on like the more paranormal aspects of some of this stuff? Are you like a full-out skeptic? Are you open-minded about it? I mean, do you think there's always going to be a more down-to-earth explanation?
Well, I think a lot of times when I'm asked that, I think my best response is that it's the wrong question. That whether I'm a skeptic or not, mm-hmm. that in my mind, it doesn't matter whether these things are real in some objective sense. What matters is this is a very meaningful story that's been told across cultures for two millennia, and that it's encoding something. Now, is it encoding something that really happened? I don't know. You know, and do I really think there's a world war between cranes and pygmies? Yeah, well, it doesn't really matter to me whether it happened or not. What's interesting is that we've been talking about it for millennia, and people who have had no contact with each other have been talking about it. And that's what I find interesting. And it's the sort of thing that it just sort of falls by the wayside because we're very, very likely to say this is history and this is folklore and never the two shall meet. History being what we consider important and folklore being what we consider trivial. But there's an awful lot that we miss, like the volcano, for instance,
sure.
That makes you wonder what other cataclysmic events have we missed. Now, are the cranes and the pygmies a stand-in for something else? Was there this long ongoing genocidal war between two people? It's a possibility, but it's interesting that it gets repeated again and again for millennia by people who wouldn't have been repeating each other's stories. They would simply have sort of in situ come up with this story, which has to be underpinned by something. I mean, maybe they had bad encounter with a crane and wanted to make them look bad. I don't know. It just seems things like that repeat themselves, I find fascinating, especially when they repeat across cultures.
Yeah, yeah.
And across time.
Yeah, because it suggests something that's either trying to be preserved or something that's ongoing.
Yeah, it's something that people noticed. And what exactly it is they noticed? Well, I mean, same thing when it comes down to UFOs. What exactly is it that somebody noticed? And whether, getting to the point where you say, well, that's not real or that's real. Well, not really the point. the point is somebody saw something. They couldn't identify it. It's an unidentified flying object.
Right.
No. And from that point, you can speculate. Oh, yeah. And it all, again, the speculations I see out there tend to involve ontological assumptions that are. And the great thing about an ontological assumption, you can't really support it. That's why it's ontological.
Right. Yeah, well, and I think that's true of most paranormal subjects.
Yeah, and I think a lot of times, and you see this in the, you know, you see the skeptics and the people who believe in whatever they believe in, you know, the Bigfoot, you know, aficionados or UFO chasers or things like that, or ghost hunters, that they get locked into this idea that they can't, that there's no room for sort of a fluid meaning, that yes, I'm seeing something. No, this is not necessarily what I think it is, but it's also not necessarily what a physical scientist would say it is. And you lose a little bit of the meaning when you get into that kind of speculation, because once somebody's determined what can and can't exist, then obviously they're going to say there was never a crane and pygmy war. Okay. And it sort of ends the conversation. It's like, yeah, there likely, you know, there wasn't an actual pygmy crane world war, but the question is, what happened? Why is everybody so interested in pygmies and cranes?
Yeah. And something, yeah.
It gets the matter of the absurdity. While you may regard life as absurd and you'll never find the existential meaning, that the search for that meaning is nonetheless valuable.
True. And I think that's kind of what keeps us going a lot of times.
Yeah, and you have to, sometimes, you know, strange things happen and you need some way to encode it in your brain. And when you need a description of what happened to you, you know, I was kidnapped by Bigfoot and I'm going to have his baby. You know, it's sounds crazy, but in that person's mind, that's what happened. Now, it's easy to say that, well, you know, you can dismiss that as this person is crazy. Or you could say something happened to them. What is the meaning of what happened to them? And, you know, let's put aside whether we believe in Bigfoot or whether we think he goes out and kidnaps people or any of these things. It means something. It's like the phantom clowns. You know, you see, clowns are creepy, and you see a clown in a dark alley. He's scary no matter what. And yeah, what is the meaning of a sudden rash of sightings of phantom clowns? Who knows? You know, maybe we've gotten over the clown. You know, circuses are sort of going away and things like that are becoming less and less popular. Maybe we're just done with clowns. And it's a significant cultural meaning.
Yeah, well, it has the whole trickster archetype in there.
Yeah.
So
we don't like tricksters. Tricksters bother us as a divine critter. Tricksters are absolutely the characterization of the absurd in religion, as far as I'm concerned. And I love them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But, you know, it's also interesting that if tricksters are presented right, for instance, Doctor Who fits the whole trickster archetype.
Oh, yeah.
And then people love them. But it has to be presented just right to, you know...
Yeah, and you know why we can stomach the trickster with at the bottom, he's the trickster with the heart of gold. You know, he has our best interests in mind. We just don't always know what our best interests are.
Right.
He'll come them for us. Whereas, you know, that makes a trickster palatable. Whereas, you know, traditionally, tricksters across various cultures don't really care that much about us. They're screwing with us because they can, and they're having fun.
Well, maybe they have a bigger plan.
Yeah. Well, and that's another thing. It's like, maybe we just don't understand.
You know, when we look at the UFO phenomenon, we look at all the possible facets. If it was, you know, really behind, you know, sightings of fairies and not really spacemen, but, you know, something else that we can't quite conceive of, they could have a plan for us that goes back millennia.
Sure.
And each individual encounter doesn't tell us anything about that plan, because we're looking at it in too small of a scope and we'll never see the full scope of it.
And that's why a lot of the descriptions of encounters seem vaguely surreal, because they make no sense. I mean, maybe they mutilate cattle because they hate cows. I don't know.
Maybe. There was a war once between the cows and
the cows and the aliens. Yeah.
But the you know, when you look at it that way, it's like, you know, maybe Valet was right, and they're just kind of like forcing our evolution in certain directions, forcing our culture in certain directions, but we wouldn't see it.
Yeah, I mean, if there was a bigger plan, it's like, can we understand what dolphins want, for instance?
Right.
You know, what would a dolphin tell us if we could talk to a dolphin? They probably have a very different view on reality, but would we be able to comprehend? I think we think of sentience as. You know, we put look at all our sci-fi. We put aliens in human suits.
Yes.
Or humans in alien suits, and then relate, or rather, humans in alien suits. And then we relate to them as we would other humans. It's very hard for us, either that or they're like, you know, like aliens, you know, the facehugger things where they're just, you know, mindlessly out to kill us.
Right.
And I'm more worried about that kind. The other kind, you know, they're amusing, but
there are some exceptions, like the stuff like Arrival, where they were certainly not human in any way, but yet not here to kill us.
Yeah,
that's the exception.
Yeah, but mostly we think that because something is sentient, we will relate to it on a level that we would relate to another human being, and that's a big assumption.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's the same way that we apply like human traits to animals. You know, your cat can mimic what you did, so it must be that it has that, you know, that same meaning to the cat, but it doesn't. You know, the cat just knows how to get a response. Or you teach your dog to shake hands, but that's not a greeting to the dog.
Yeah. Yeah, the cat's purring. He's happy. What he's really doing is probably like plotting your death.
Well, aren't they all? Yeah. That's also a long-term plan. One of the things you mentioned when we were talking, emailing back and forth, I just lost the tab. There was something, Moonface people?
Oh, the Moonface people. Yeah, that's another another genocidal war that nobody talks about.
Or Moon-Eyed people is what you said.
Moon-Eyed people, yeah. That's in North America. And a lot of this gets kind of sucked into the whole Columbus was a jerk and let's find anybody else who first discovered America kind of stuff, which is, you know, always amusing, you know, obviously, you know, the Vikings got here at some point, and
sure,
there's even a few thing about Chinese Buddhist monks on the Pacific coast in the 5th century AD. And you know, which I always think explains a lot about California, but the big eyed, the technical name for them was the Azgan, and they stories of them were first found in territory between West Virginia and Georgia, and Europeans started meandering into the frontiers of Ohio, Kentucky, Tennessee about in the early 1700s, and the Shawnee were the tribe that was occupying the area in Ohio at the time. And they sent out a guy named Thomas Bullitt to Chillicothe, Ohio, to request permission from the Shawnee because they want to open up some of the land in Kentucky, which was absolutely beautiful. And the Shawnee told them they were basically on crack because the Shawnee would hunt in Kentucky, but they absolutely refused to set up any permanent settlements there. And they said they didn't own the land. And when they asked them who does own the land, they said it was the ghosts of the murdered Azgan tribe.
Huh.
And the way they described them, they called them the moon-eyed people. They're moon-eyed nocturnal creatures. I mean, so we're not talking about a group of Caucasians running around. They were pretty clear. These are moon-eyed, pale-skinned people that can't come out in the light, which sounds awfully like the Living Dead to me, but that's where I go to, you know.
Or the mole people.
Or the mole people, exactly. So by the time they were telling these stories, they were pretty much familiar with, you know, the white settlers. So this they were pretty sure that these were not the same thing. And they, the Europeans went ahead and started setting up farms and, you know, whiskey distilleries and whatever else they wanted to in Kentucky. And the natives said, you know, they had a name for it that translated as the dark and bloody ground. And they're like, we call it that for a reason. And there's some fictionalized accounts of these discussions between the Shawnee and Thomas Bullitt that get repeated on the internet all the time as if they're real. You can look at the folklore and get the folklore very easily, but then there's also some fictionalized accounts, and then I don't think we actually have a record of the conversation between Chief Blackfish and Thomas Bullitt.
Right, right. Wait, you mean they weren't? They didn't have like a stenographer there recording
everything? Yeah. Somebody wrote a book called The Frontiersman. I can't remember his name. It was Eckert. Eckert was the guy's name. And it was written in 1967, and actually Church of Latter-day Saints picked up on it, and as evidence that the Book of Mormon correctly depicts the unruly white people crawling around North America preaching the gospel.
Mm, yeah.
But the stories that they have are that right around about 1500 AD, a Spanish conquistador reported these stories that were being told to him. But that they weren't around by the time he had arrived. And the Cherokee legends, they talk about how they were in the vicinity of Georgia, and the Cherokee were actually an Iroquoian people, so they migrated south, probably from somewhere around the Great Lakes, and they probably pushed, and the way it worked was, you know, one tribe would start moving south and they'd push a tribe in front of them and so on and so forth. And the Cherokee moved through southern Appalachia into Kentucky and Tennessee and the Carolinas and then into Georgia, where they eventually encountered settlers. But they reported that they displaced the Moon-Eyed people from Kentucky as they worked their way through. And the Shawnee of Ohio say that they wiped them out completely, which is interesting. You got different tribes saying that they did different things. So the Shawnee said they wiped them out, but the Cherokees say, well, when we arrived, there were still some there, and we agreed, don't settle in Kentucky, and they kept pushing south and wound up pushing apparently these Moon-Eyed people, the Azgen, into Tennessee and then into Georgia. And when the Cherokees arrived in Georgia, there was immediately conflict with the Chickasaws, the Choctaws, the Creeks. Everybody was fighting for land and territory. And the Creeks, interestingly, who were probably in southern Appalachia and Georgia before the Cherokee arrived, had a similar tradition of the Moon-Eyed people and said they wiped them out. They got a lot of people who are like openly saying, yeah, there were these, nocturnal critters and they're day blind and moon-eyed and pale skinned. And we wiped them out. And this tradition persists across a lot of these, across multiple tribes that all seem to be quite proud of having wiped out the Moon-Eyed people. There's been some speculation that some of the ruins that you see in the hills in Georgia are sort of the last stand of the of the Azgen before they were completely wiped out.
Huh. Yeah, I've never heard about that. That's really interesting.
What's interesting about it is that there was a weird pattern of settlement where in geographical Kentucky and West Virginia and sort of that area, fertile land, but relatively sparsely settled by Native Americans. And this is while tribes were all around fighting for land and pushing each other in, farther south or farther west. And yet nobody really wanted to settle in that area. And it was all about these Moon-Eyed Azgen.
Well, there are also the Native American legends about how they wiped out giants and like the red-haired giants and stuff. And then we found actual mummies of red-haired giants in a cave, yeah. And it's like, okay, well, maybe there was something to these stories.
Yeah. Oh, and lots of stories about a version of fairies that interacted with Native Americans that at some point were either wiped out or disappeared. These stories reoccur all over the place.
Hmm. The same with the whole Bigfoot thing in Native Americans. You get that in a lot of Native American cultures acknowledge that Bigfoot is out there in different ways.
Oh, yeah. And wild men and things like that. And The funny thing is a lot of that, maybe it's encoding something. And that's always been my point is I wrote one recently on the Basque.
Hmm.
And the Basque, what's interesting about them is that their language is the only language in Europe that bears no resemblance to any other European language. It's not from the Indo-European family of languages. And there's other genetic things that mark a distinct Basqueness that indicate they've been there right there at the western end of the Pyrenees for a very, very, very long time.
Now, don't they have a unique blood type as well?
Yeah, I forget whether it's Rh negative or Rh positive, it's usually represented in the population way above anybody else, any other population. So there's a lot of genetic uniqueness there that has, and that coupled with the language, they know that the Basques were there at least before agriculture arrived in Spain. So that puts it back 7,000 years. But there's some speculation that the Basque may be a remnant of indigenous populations that were there when the Indo-Europeans came sweeping out of the out of Asia, Central Asia, into Europe. And what I found fascinating is there's lots. And so given that there's the possibility that the Basque could have been there for 25,000 years, that would not be a completely unreasonable assumption. But that would almost, according to, and our notion of when there, we do, anthropologists agree, there was some overlap in Europe between Cro-Magnon, the first Homo sapiens, mm-hmm. and Neanderthals. And the dates are a little uncertain. I mean, sometimes they say the last Neanderthal probably died somewhere around 40,000 years past, but they say in Spain that it actually lasted a lot longer. And the time frame is such that stories that the Basques have of something they call the Gentilac, which, and I'm probably terribly mispronouncing it because I don't speak a word of Basque. it's a furry giant, 10, 15 feet tall. It's grown a lot in retelling, but they talk about them as having lived in the mountains and they shared some farming techniques with the Basque. And they, they just talked about interacting with these more or less gentle giants living up in the hills. And you got to ask yourself, if the Basque were there for 25,000 years and at some point overlapped the last of the Neanderthal, an earlier Cro-Magnon group, is that so hard to believe? And that's a kind of a theme with me I like to find things where you can say, is that so hard to believe? And then I pull a bait and switch and say, well, if you believe that, let me tell you another one.
and the thing is, our history is so incomplete. You don't even have to go that far back, like the volcano you mentioned, to show how little we really know about history.
Well, yeah. All I got to do is look up a list of phantom islands and all the islands we've lost. They were there at one point, we lost them, or maybe they were never there and somebody just couldn't navigate.
They're holdovers from when, from the Ice Age, when these things were above water before the ice caps melt.
Yeah, and there's lots and lots of things we seem to miss. I mean, Göbekli Tepe is a good thing. That sat there, nobody noticed it for a long time, and now they're seeing something they would have presumed could not exist previously.
Yeah, well, the water damage on the Sphinx, that was, a welcomed discovery, and the Antikythera mechanism.
Yeah, I just countless things that just don't have a really good explanation. And some of them I like because they're just so odd. You know, the Antikythera mechanism I like because it's like, what is that and why does that exist?
Yeah.
And, you know, there's no real good explanation for it.
And the thing is, it's not, I don't know if there's no good explanation for it. It's that we've obviously missed something.
Or it seems, given our current timeline, it seems out of time.
Yeah.
Whatever an anachronism is going forward, because it seems that our history says at this time this could not have existed, yet here it is, and it exists.
Right, and if it exists on that form, there must have been previous forms, and we've just never found them. So what else are we missing?
Yeah, stuff burns, we break stuff, you know, it gets buried. We have cataclysms that we don't notice.
Exactly.
You know, it's surprising how much we lose, and if it gets written down, it's remembered and it becomes history. And,
or it's assumed that it's myth.
Yeah.
Depending on who wrote it down.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Aristotle had plenty of weird stuff to say, and we take him seriously.
And we take Plato seriously about everything but Atlantis.
Yeah. Well, and that's funny. It's like we read it and the guy's this is genius, but Atlantis never existed. Well, maybe it didn't, but, you know, he was talking about something. Maybe it was just a metaphor. But again,
right.
You know, these things don't, unless the guy's a great fiction writer, and then we want to say that he's the fantastic fiction writer. I don't think most people think of him that way. They say this guy was encoding something meaningful. And whether it was a real continent or not is not terribly important. He had something to say about it.
Well, you know, and that's interesting, too, because that's a secondhand story that was told to him.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not like it was told directly to him. It's already gone through one other person, if I remember right. Wasn't it Solon who told him?
Yeah.
And so it's gone through one other person at least. And then, you know, it is interesting to me because it matches up with the end of the last ice age when you look at the dates.
Yeah.
And it could be that mixed with other things that just over time got all kind of flurried together. So we get a little bit of this and a little bit of that.
Well, history is a game of telephone.
Yeah.
The way it's you're never quite sure what the story is and it's who writes it. And I'm not a big conspiracy theorist. Well, I can't say that exactly. I think that the problem with our modern conspiracy theories is that they're often generated by people who are very unhappy with our current consensus reality.
Hmm.
And rather than making the tweaks or doing those few obnoxious things that kind of throw a wrench into the standard consensus reality and call things into question, they want to overturn it. They want something completely different to be true. And I think that leads you down pathways that, where you start making assumptions that are not necessarily supported, not necessarily wrong, but not supported.
Hmm. Usually what I see when I start looking into certain conspiracies is that you get, okay, here's a fact, and here's a fact, and here's a fact, and then they tied them together in a way that could make sense, but there's no evidence that that's how they're tied together.
Yeah.
And I feel like a lot of people don't understand there's a difference there. Just because you could tie these two things together doesn't mean they are tied together.
Yeah, it's a narrative. It's just like I think in Foucault's Pendulum, the Umberto Eco book.
Oh yeah, that's a fantastic book.
Oh yeah, the publisher guys are talking to an occult enthusiast, and the guy comes in and is talking to them about the latest book on pyramidology he read and how this book talks about the pyramid essentially encodes a timeline of everything that's happened in the world and
right.
The future based on it and by doing the measurements properly. And they say, well, you believe that? And he says, no, hell no. And he proceeds to show them by taking a newsstand in Paris and measuring its dimensions and then predicting, you know, similar, you know, saying,
yeah,
hey, look,
yeah.
We've seen in Paris, its dimensions predict, you know, all the things that happened in history that are important. And they at the end, they say, well, so you don't believe in numerology of any kind. He said, no. It's not that I don't believe in numerology. It's that I think what's encoded in numerology is far beyond what we're ascribing to it. He says, these things are recapitulating a bigger pattern. Which kind of goes to what we were talking about, that like, why would we understand what the, you know, what the alien actually intends to do, whether they have some long-term goal and are that to us looks absurd, but you know, if you've got a few thousand years to wait, maybe it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And you know, the universe may have a plan for us all, but it may not be a plan that we can understand.
Or one that we like.
Yeah, well, that too. That's the concept of dharma always interested me in that, because you know it would be translated as right action, and you know the I would always hear, well, that's not really what it means from Sanskrit. It doesn't actually mean right action like we think of right action. It means this is the thing that's supposed to happen. So it's not right as in good or bad. It's this is almost like this is the fated action that's supposed to happen.
This was meant to be. Yeah.
I remember I had watched I think PBS or something aired a miniseries on the Mahabharata, and they were showing I can't remember now if it was Krishna or so, one of the gods talking about how he didn't want to go into this war. You know, he didn't want to go into this battle, and you know, they were saying, well, don't. And he's like, no, it's dharma. It must happen. You know?
Yeah. And that's probably what's going to happen to us in the next few years.
Could be. Let's hope not. I mean, I kind of feel that way about 9/11. Like 9/11 was something that had to happen.
Really?
You know, like I feel like it was one of those points in history that for whatever reason it needed to happen. I mean, as horrible as it was, and no matter who's behind it, for some reason that was one of those things that needed to happen. And I wonder too, with the random number generators and stuff, where they all kind of stop being random when it happened.
Yeah.
If that's an indication of that, or if that's just consciousness doing that.
So you think it's sort of, it woke people up to something.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, it obviously changed our world in drastic ways.
Yeah.
For better or worse can only be seen in time. I mean, it seems like it changed it for worse immediately, but who knows, 20 or 30 years down the line.
It's true.
Let's hit one more of the things that you had brought up here, which was the you're going to have to say that one. Nitawio?
The Nitawio genocide. Yeah, that was another interesting little bit of folklore that involves another group of people getting completely wiped out, which I find it strange that there's so many stories where it's sort of celebrated that people have just basically massacred another people.
Right.
And it's this particular one I got to remember where exactly it happened. I'm pretty sure that it was in Ceylon. Sorry, I write a lot of these things, and so
I know.
So there's So there's stories in Ceylon, so modern day Sri Lanka, that come from 5th century Greek historians, and where they talk about that in India, there are a group of people that, I'm trying to get the description right, the smallest, again, this actually kind of sounds like the Pygmies again, by the way, although they didn't fight the cranes. they said they speak the same language as the other inhabitants of the country. They're very short. The tallest being only 2 cubits in height, and I think that's what, like a foot and a half. Most of them only 1.5. Very long hair, beards larger than those of any other men, And when their beards are full grown, they leave off wearing clothes.
They sound like the sort of myth, the sort of fantasy image of like a dwarf or something.
Yeah, a little bit. And then they fasten their hair around them like a girdle. It serves them as clothes. And they, of course, the Greeks, and so they called them snub-nosed and ugly, because anybody who wasn't Greek was, you know, may as well have been a savage. But these guys are reported later by a Moroccan scholar who traveled on a grand tour of North Africa, Horn of Africa, West Africa, Middle East, South Asia. He went everywhere, Southeast Asia and China, and he published it in a book called the Rila, I believe it's called. Again, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but that translates to journey. And he hopped a ship in Calcutta, which stopped in Sri Lanka, and there he picked up a similar story, where he, of course, said, "Oh, this is probably just some unknown species of monkey," but the locals insisted, "This is not a monkey. These are people," and they had distinct descriptions of them, and that they were basically wiped out before he had ever arrived. He continuously referred to them as monkeys, but locals referred to them as the Nidaweo. And the Nidaweo, he was told, were a cruel and savage race of men. And they built platforms in trees, covered them with leaves and thatch. They spoke Sinhalese and Tamil and various languages, but their language sounded odd. And they attacked anybody who intruded into their territory, because their territory apparently was where there was lots of honey. And so people went in there to collect honey, and they would attack them. And their ancestors fought the Nidaweo and drove them into a cavern, the last remnant of them, piled firewood outside the entrance and burned it, and basically, you know, suffocated them. And it's interesting to see some of the explanations, because a lot of British civil servants would speculate on what these were, and some said, "Oh no, they're just talking about sun bears, which are local there." And like, no, they're pretty clear. These aren't bears or monkeys.
Yeah. Explanations like that assume that the other people telling the stories are not smart enough to know the difference.
Yeah, frankly, a lot of these people would probably be better acquainted with the animals that they're British civil servants were identifying than the British civil servants. And they lived in. It's amazing, because they pulled so much ethnographic information on these from locals, that they lived in small gangs of 10 or 20, and they captured animals by surrounding them, and that's why they lived in small troops, and they tended to live in caves and hollow trees, and the females were shorter than the males. They spoke a language that was a little bit like the twittering of birds, but they understood these other languages. They were very afraid of dogs. They never came near the sea. They just had such the informants that they were speaking to had such rich ethnographic data on these people that, you know, it's like they knew they weren't bears or monkeys, and they were pretty clear on what happened. But they said that around 1400 AD, as far as they could tell, they'd been wiped out. It was basically, they said, 400 years before the British anthropologists and civil servants who were there interviewing them had arrived, which would have made it about 1400 AD, that they had wiped out the Nidaweo completely. And these are the sort of things that, like, you just wonder. It's like, what in the world was going on? Because they're very clear that these aren't humans per se, and they're not animals. They have a culture. They apparently a pretty rich culture, given the descriptions, and yet they were wiped out. Which is, of course, that's the whole history of humanity: is one bunch of savages coming after another bunch of savages and pushing them out. I mean, it's colonialism in a nutshell, you know.
Yeah.
It's been going on forever, you know. What's interesting is that the detail with which these things from the Asgen in North America to the Pygmy Crane Wars, the detail with which these things are described by people sort of precludes the idea that they're just telling tales, that this is just, haha, let's make fun of the stupid European and tell him a tall tale.
Right, right.
Because it's repeated across many informants, and they're told some pretty horrific things. I mean, you would want to at least make yourself look a little better, wouldn't you?
You would think. But then again, you know, there's the whole idea that, you know, our mankind itself just kind of is proud of the war that it commits, you know?
Yeah.
So those are victories that they are proud of.
Yeah, and when we destroy the Earth, it'll probably be by mistake.
Yeah, well,
there's some truth to that. A lot of mythology is quite horrific and is about the besting of some horrible creature or some terrible people. Yeah. So there's a lot of truth to that. What's interesting is that they get repeated. These stories are repeated again and again. And that often an element of this, there's a moral element to the story where, take the Asgen, for instance, that even though everybody seemed to claim to have a hand in wiping them out, they avoided their territory because they were the murdered ghosts, which is an interesting take on it. It's that, wow, we killed these guys. We murdered these guys. And, they probably aren't happy with us. But you see how there's like a moral lesson twisted in there. It's like, we did something wrong and we're now afraid to live in the area where this happened. So it's interesting. It doesn't quite fit with the standard model of the mythological model of, we went and we, you know, knocked around the nasty Trojans because Greeks are so awesome and they deserved it.
Right, right.
But the Spartans versus the Persians and all those kinds of stories, they don't have a strong moral lesson to them, and that's why I find some of these, the ones where they have a very odd element like that, more appealing, because it just doesn't fit with sort of our standard model of mythology and folklore.
Yeah,
While folklore is supposed to talk about liminal things, I think the most interesting folklore is the folklore that talks about the liminal things. So things that are liminal even to folklore.
Fair enough. So where can people find you?
Where can people find me?
Yes.
Under my desk, hiding in fear.
Okay, that's a good. That's from the monsters, right?
Exactly. You mean my? You mean the blog?
I do mean the blog.
Okay, you can find it at esoterix.com. That's esoterix.com.
Okay. Are you on any social networking sites as well?
I'm on Tumblr, esoterix, esoterix.tumblr.com. I'm on Twitter at esoterix. I can only handle so much social media before I have a meltdown, so I'm
understandable. All right, well, thank you so much for spending some time talking to us about this. The blog is great. You got such a variety of information there, and I love the frightening thoughts along the side.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it. And then I do have thing on the blog. It's called Small Bites of Strangeness from Esoterix. And that's, you'll notice a lot of my articles are very long and heavily referenced and tend to go on and on. My wife won't even read some of them. She says they're too long. Those Small Bites of Strangeness are from an earlier blog that I wrote that, I decided that I'd preserve here, and then it connects to the Tumblr account that also has all of my other esoteric stuff. So if you just want some quick reads, you can read about dog deaths on Overton Bridge, which is the most dangerous place on Earth for depressed pets, or the D list of fallen angels, or various little little articles dashed off, you know, if you want to know where all the ancient Roman ghosts are, you know, that kind of thing.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you again.
Sure. And thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that. As I said, there is a Patreon extra segment with Aaron talking about a demon who once testified in court. It's a pretty interesting story. And remember, you have been listening to Where Did the Road Go? And you can find everything Where Did the Road Go related at wheredidtheroadgo.com. And that's links to all of our media, all of the ways to follow us, and Patreon accounts, and everything else you could possibly need. So go check it out. To take you out tonight, we're going to be hearing from a band called The Beautiful Kings. And The Beautiful Kings are from, I believe, Pittsburgh, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, Pittsburgh. Yeah, Pittsburgh. And you can find them at beautifulkings.com. And we're going to hear a song from them called Secret Town. See you next time. Thank you.